Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank. Focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We have today a tale of two stocks, one an icon of American retail. It issues a profit warning and promptly loses 10% of its value. The other, troubled for years, warns investors as well and finishes up 0.2%. The common denominator, then, for Sears and Home Depot, once again, the still-stumbling housing market. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, representing America's public transportation industry, delivering 10 billion riders annually, and working for an energy-independent America. PublicTransportation.org. Science and technology reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Glad you could be here on this Tuesday. It's July the 10th today. And with apologies to Mr. Dickens, the best of times won't be happening in the housing market anytime soon. Sears and Home Depot, as I mentioned, announced profit warnings today. Sears said second quarter earnings would be about half of what analysts had been expecting. That's thanks in part to slow sales of home appliances. Home Depot loses because people aren't buying things to fix up homes they're not buying. Along those lines, home builder D.R. Horton, one of the biggest in the country, announced falling home values will lead to its first quarterly loss since it listed on the NYSE 12 years ago. From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
In a hot housing market, customers flock to Sears and Home Depot. They spend on items to make their home a more comfortable space or to fix it up for sale. Christopher Thornburg is principal of Beacon Economics.
With the market going the other way, the desire and really in many ways, the financial value of making those kind of adjustments to your house are just not there anymore.
He says this year, far fewer people than last year are borrowing money against their homes. He says retailers were benefiting from that extra spending, so they're bound to suffer now. Analyst Richard Hastings with Bernard Sand says retailers may look shaky, but home builders like D.R. Horton are really in trouble.
This is really a massive multi-year housing crisis. We have not even gotten to second base yet. Mid-2008, we'll find out where we're at.
Christopher Thornburg says home builders got too excited during the housing boom and massively overbuilt. Those homes now sit empty.
You've had a circumstance in which really we have at least probably a year and a half of excess supply of new homes right now.
He says it'll be at least 2.5 years before the home construction market recovers. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
If you happen to be one of the diminishing few who hope the end of the housing slide might still be in sight, consider the latest from Standard & Poor's. The credit rating company said this morning it's considering cutting its ratings on a mountain of mortgage-related debt, subprime debt specifically. Those are the bonds issued by some of the big banks that have been pumping cash into the housing market for years. Moody's wasn't about to be left behind. This afternoon, it went ahead and cut its ratings. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke gave a speech today to a group of academic economists. We'll spare you the painful details. Suffice it to say, he didn't make anybody feel great about the overall economy, which only added to the gloom and doom on Wall Street. There was news this afternoon from Chicago about the Conrad Black trial. The jury considering the fate of the man who once controlled the Chicago Sun-Times and London's Daily Telegraph said it can't reach a verdict in Black's fraud trial. The judge said he's going to order him to go back and try again. You've probably heard by now that Apple's new iPhone comes with an AT&T service contract and only an AT&T service contract. Deals like that are great for big business, arguably not so great for consumers. But callers everywhere may soon have more choices when it comes to how they use their cell phones. There's a vote in the Federal Communications Commission coming up on the latest auction of wireless airwaves, really, really valuable wireless airwaves. And there's word of a proposal soon to be floating around the FCC under which that auction would require something called open access. Marketplace's Sam Eaton explains.
If the high-tech industry had a wish list for the Federal Communications Commission, open access would be at the top. Companies like Google have been pressuring the government to sell wireless airwaves with the condition that they remain open to all users. Now it looks like Google may get that wish. Open access would allow it to enter the wireless marketplace both through its software and as a service provider. But technology analyst Rob Enderle says high-tech firms aren't the only ones who would benefit.
When you open up a market to competition, generally the consumer wins. Prices come down, access goes up.
The airwaves in question are a huge slice of bandwidth being freed up as the television industry transitions to a digital signal. The sale, which will happen early next year, offers a rare opportunity to enter the crowded wireless marketplace. And with a potential price tag of $20 billion, dominant wireless carriers like AT&T and Verizon are balking at the possibility of having to share those airwaves.
This is potentially welfare for Silicon Valley.
Joe Farron is with the wireless industry trade group CTIA.
It says, we're going to elevate government mandate above consumer demand.
Farron says that strategy could backfire. He says requiring open access would diminish the value of the new airwaves ahead of the sale, potentially robbing U.S. taxpayers of billions of dollars. But tech analyst Rob Enderle says at least they won't be paying several hundred dollars a month to connect their new iPhones to the Internet. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
It wasn't just stocks that lost ground today. The dollar hit an all-time low against the euro and a 26-year low on the British pound, which reminds me to mention this. The big European indices, which aren't much interested in how Home Depot or Sears is doing, closed down 1% or more across the board. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The future of robotics is on display this week in Chicago. Taser, the stun gun company, is having its annual product demonstration there at what it calls a tactical conference. Among the offerings is a shotgun shell that shoots wireless stun gun rounds and a robot that comes equipped with a taser of its own. The company says it could be used in prisons or even in combat, which is a far cry from Detroit using robots to cut down on automobile manufacturing costs. John Pike's the director of GlobalSecurity.org. Mr. Pike, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
So who's buying these things?
Well, at this point, you're seeing a lot of interest from the Pentagon. The service is looking at where you can put robots. Just about any place that you have a human being right now, they're trying to figure out how they can automate it. Because the bottom line is that the Pentagon is in competition with the private sector for personnel, for labor. The private sector is substituting capital, technology, automation for labor. And the Pentagon has to do the same thing, or their labor costs are just going to go through the roof.
Who are they selling to besides the Pentagon?
I think that there also is a lot of interest in robotic guards for anybody who has a large warehouse that needs to be guarded at night. Certainly the correction system. And you might also imagine cops on the beat, neighborhood policing with robots, although I think maybe that's a little further down the road.
It's a business opportunity in a lot of ways. Not only can you take the human being out of the equation so you don't have to pay for security guards or for more soldiers, but also sort of in the ancillary benefits that come with just having robotics in the system?
Well, there are an enormous number of advantages in having robotic guards or robotic soldiers. Robots don't get bored. Robots do exactly what they're told. You don't have to write condolence letters for them. They are infinitely brave. When you don't need them, you can shrink wrap them and put them in storage. They don't have families that need to have housing. And if you put them on a battlefield with lethal weapons, they will kill without remorse. They will kill without pity and without compunction, which is not something that you would say about human soldiers.
You know, it's great to be able to take soldiers out of harm's way, and it's great to not have to put people in situations where they could get killed or possibly have to kill somebody else. But what about security companies who say, you know, we generate 1,000 jobs in this community guarding the prison, or, you know, it's a great source of employment for young people?
Well, I think that they also have to understand that it's an extremely hazardous, extremely stressful job. It's not one that people are always going to be attracted to. And certainly any of those guards, I think, would prefer to be teleoperating a device that would not be able to feel pain rather than having to go in there and get beat up themselves. I think it would certainly be better for the guards, better for the inmates for that much longer.
All right. Well, then what's the next big innovation in robotics?
The big development that you're looking at over the next 5 to 15 years is increasing degrees of autonomy, that you can give the robot mission orders, apprehend everybody who's in the building, and the robot would follow through with all of the rest. That's what the big development is going to be. That's where you're going to see sudden advances. That's where the unfolding of Moore's Law, the doubling of computing power every 18 months, that's where you're starting to get into the field of RoboCop or Terminator, not in the next 5 years, but you look 10 years down the road, and that's what you're starting to look at. And at that point, there are all kinds of applications that people are going to be interested in.
Mr. Pike, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
John Pike from the website globalsecurity.org. Tune into the baseball All-Star game tonight, and you'll see all the big names, the guys who make all the big money. But most professional ballplayers are people you've probably never heard of. They spend their careers going up and sometimes down the minor leagues, where the average salary is $1,000 a month. So players look for ways to stretch their paychecks with a little help from their friends, as Marketplace's Nancy Fargali reports.
Sandy Wakefield is 65. She goes by the name Mama, and Mama has house rules. No tobacco, no women, and no home-cooked meals after midnight.
You know, it's your home, and they have to respect that.
She's not talking about her blood relations. She's talking about her baseball relations. Imagine opening your home to a minor league player. Now imagine doing that 50 times over 6 years. Tough, yeah, but the players need it.
Rather than them renting an apartment, because in this area apartments run anywhere from $1,200 to $1,800 for a one- or two-bedroom, they'll crowd into one bedroom and just so they don't have to pay rent.
The players are from the Rancho Cucamonga Quakes. This season, Sandy is housing 3 Quakes from Latin America.
They bring home maybe $850 a month. And everybody thinks, oh, they make the big bucks, but they don't at this level. They have to pay their dues.
So that means living with a host family. The entire Rancho team does it, and the same thing is happening in minor league towns across the country. Families host players who one day may earn more money in a year than the family makes over a lifetime. Take one of Sandy's former boarders. He earns more than $400,000 a year. Quite a bit more than Sandy's yearly retirement income of $30,000.
With the price of gas this year, I told him, I said, I don't mind driving you around, you know, taking you to the gym, taking you to the field. I said, but I don't have the money on my income with gas over $3 a gallon to pay for gas. So when we need gas, they all chip in.
So why open your home and wallet to players who can be gone the next day? Sandy says it keeps her life active. She's learning Spanish to talk with the players whom she calls her boys. And she's always taking care of meals.
Cookies, banana bread, fruit, whatever the That one.
Her cell phone rings before she finishes her list. It's Jose, a Quakes player from another host family who can't get to gym practice.
Hi. Do you need a ride today?
Only 4 to 5% of minor league players will ever make it to the majors. And by making it, I mean playing even for a single day. That's according to Pat Doyle, a minor league baseball researcher. He says host families are essential when a player starts out. The minor league salaries are low, and the teams give players little time to mature.
The only thing that they want to do is to basically develop the best ball players, get them through the system, and have them in the majors as quickly as possible.
Francisco Rodriguez is in that system. Rodriguez is from Mexico. His current salary is $850 a month.
We can save a lot of money here. People like Sandy, it's great for us because if we need to pay rent in the states like California, it's really, really expensive. Maybe a lot of players like us, foreign players, can quit.
Rodriguez gave his $50,000 signing bonus to his dad. He says that living with Sandy has helped, but there's one thing she can't afford to help with, the long-distance calls. So if her players want to talk to their family overseas, they need calling cards. And that brings us to this discussion in the car ride to the gym.
Anthony said he wanted a calling card, but we only have 20 minutes to get to the gym and we have to pick up Jose.
So?
No tiempo.
The boys say the store might be closed after the game, so Sandy volunteers to pick up the cards herself. Another favor for another group of players who have a new mother in a new home. I'm Nancy Fergali for Marketplace.
We've got a picture of Sandy Wakefield and some of the players she's hosting on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, the wall fell, the economy tanked, and now you can't even get a date.
There are no such huge areas like Eastern Germany in Europe with such a disproportional sex ratio.
But first, let's do the numbers. Take some not-too-optimistic comments about inflation from Fed Chief Ben Bernanke. Add subprime mortgage worries and company profit warnings, and you have the perfect storm on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials thundered down 148 points, about 0.1% to end the day at 13,501. The Nasdaq blew off 30 points, 0.1% to finish at 26,39. The S&P 500 poured down 21 points. That's 1.4% to close at 1510. We talked about Moody's and Standard & Poor's downgrading securities backed by subprime loans. That dropped a pretty major bomb on big financial companies. Bear Stearns lopped off more than 4%. Goldman Sachs fell 2.75%. American Express dropped 0.3%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 5.02%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com. Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, a House committee examines wireless innovation and consumer protection. It's World Population Day, a day for the United Nations to raise awareness of development and population issues around the globe. And it's the anniversary of the television show that put your knowledge of your beloved to the test. The Newlywed Game premiered on July 11th, 1966. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. About 1,000 Sprint cell phone subscribers are about to have their signals fade out permanently. Sprint's cutting them off for calling customer service a lot. Too much, says the company. Sprint has 53 million subscribers, so the unlucky losers make up only a minute slice of them, to be fair. But aren't customer calls what customer service is for? We sent Marketplace's Steve Tripoli to ask around.
Sprint's hardly the first company to fire some of its customers. Analyst Scott Ellison at IDC says this story's making news because Sprint's action has been plastered all over the web.
This is a very typical customer service issue that's become very public in the internet age.
Raul Katz is with Columbia University's Institute for Teleinformation. He says U.S. wireless providers do spark more complaints than providers elsewhere.
It's probably issues related to network coverage. It's probably issues related to billing.
Katz says all the U.S. wireless firms are struggling to balance three strategies for dealing with their big complainers.
One is you go the hard way, the way Sprint did. The other one is you try to eliminate the reasons why customers call you. The other one is you provide some ways by which they interact with the voice response unit.
In other words, cast them into that special hell known as, please wait, your call is very important to us. The blogosphere was abuzz about Sprint's move. Here's a voiceover rendition of what we read today.
Good for Sprint. I have to agree. Some people are never satisfied.
These people constantly call because their service blows. I had Sprint and had to constantly call about dropped calls.
Does this mean they'll let me out of my contract if I call them a lot too?
Sprint did give their 1,000 big complainers what you might call the velvet boot. They got a month's notice, their final bill is free, and they were warned to switch before July 30th so that they can keep their phone numbers. Oh yeah, and there was no early termination fee. Now that would have really lit up the blogosphere. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
You know what the music means? It's time to read your letters. There are always a couple of subjects we cover that generate a lot of mail. This time around, it was Chinese imports. Much has been made of recalled Chinese products, pet food, toothpaste, and most recently, toys. Last week, we quoted the president of the Toy Industry Association, and his remarks left William Cole and a few other listeners unsettled.
I enjoyed the piece on Chinese products, but I was shocked that Carter Keithley thought he was putting my mind at ease when he stated that 99.9% of Chinese products are safe, and then stated that there were 3 billion toys sent to the United States. By my calculations, that suggests 3 million toys are not safe. I'd say that's not a very good record. I think I'll buy a lottery ticket instead. My odds are better there.
Another story that ruffled a few feathers was about the closure of Hooters outlets across New England. We noted that the restaurant known for buxom waitresses was demographically not a good fit for the home of the Puritans. Bobby Blake of Connecticut argued New Englanders aren't Puritans but progressive and find Hooters restaurants adolescent and behind the times. Listener Anthony LaBruna chalked it up to this.
Perhaps it is something as simple as bad taste has fallen out of fashion. I would guess that Hooters is most popular in the same areas that care about what happens to Paris Hilton.
Yesterday on the program, we aired a commentary on bankruptcy and entrepreneurship. We said debtors are barred from filing Chapter 7 if, after taking a means test, their income is above the state median wherever they happen to live. Bankruptcy lawyer Robert Schwartz was one of many in his profession to write in with a correction.
You're barred from Chapter 7 only if your income is above the median and your expenses are low enough to leave you with enough disposable income to fund a feasible Chapter 13 repayment plan.
And finally, a couple of weeks ago, James Brown of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, caught both host and reporter using the word loan questionably.
When did the word loan become a verb? Your lead story kept talking about banks loaning money. The verb is lend. Banks that lend money are known as lenders, not loaners. Shakespeare did not write, friends, Romans, countrymen, loan me your ear.
To cite the Oxford Dictionary of American Style and Usage, Mr. Brown, loan can be a verb when you're talking about money. Loan us your thoughts or lend them, whichever you prefer. If you have any comments, go to our website. It's marketplace.org. All you have to do is click on the link that says contact. Economists had all kinds of predictions when the Berlin Wall came down almost 18 years ago. The German reunification would turn out to be far more expensive than anybody thought. That East German businesses would never be able to hold their own in the face of capitalist competition. And that young people would leave the East in droves looking for opportunity on the other side of the wall. They were right on the first two, And on the last one as well, except they didn't quite nail down who would leave. Kyle James reports.
The town of Finsterwalde, an hour and a half south of Berlin, just celebrated its 725th anniversary. There was a three-day street party. Bands, bratwurst stands, and speeches extolling the town's prosperous past. But 25-year-old resident Tilo Merton sums up what a lot of young people here think about its future.
Most of the people go away from here. There's no future in Finsterwalde.
It's the same in many parts of the former East Germany. Unemployment rates hover around 20% here. With few jobs, an estimated 10% of the population has packed bags and headed west. A new study found that many who've said Auf Wiedersehen are young women in their 20s. The result? In some rural regions, there are just 75 young women left for every 100 young men.
There are no such huge areas like Eastern Germany in Europe with such a disproportional sex ratio.
Stefan Klune is the social scientist who authored the study, called Too Many Men. He says he was surprised to find out that Eastern German women are usually better educated than men and more ready to take life by the horns.
Higher qualified people are more mobile. They wish to have a better job, a better income, and that leads to the fact that women left Eastern Germany more than men.
27-year-old Melanie Vetter was born and raised in Herzberg, just down the road from Finsterwalde. She loves it here, but she knows she'll probably have to do what 18 of the 20 women in her graduating class did, leave home to find work.
Of course I'd be happy if I could find something here in Herzberg. I don't want to leave the place, or my boyfriend. But a person has goals and desires, and you can't live off air and love alone.
Those who leave usually don't come back. They find boyfriends in the cities where they find work, get married, and start families. Even if they'd like to settle down with a hometown boy, they often find that despite the male surplus, the pickings aren't good. The gender imbalance has led to a new male-dominated underclass in many areas of the East. Herzberg's mayor, Michael Uknik, often sees the young men left behind. They gather in the square outside his window, poorly educated, on welfare, usually single.
Ja, die hier keine Arbeit haben. Die sind dann arbeitslos.
Those that don't find work, they worry us. Not everyone, but there are those that become a problem for a small city like ours. They drink, they get together at bus stops and hang out, and often get involved in crime.
This group of frustrated, aimless men is perfect fodder for neo-Nazi groups looking for new members. The study found that right-wing radical parties in Germany get more votes in areas where most young women have left. Back at the celebration in Finsterwalde, the town singers are performing after the mayor gives a speech calling on citizens not to give up hope on the region's economic future. But it's a hard sell. As the young and educated leave, the skilled workforce declines. Companies stay away, eroding the economy further. Irene Gampa heads up the city's Department of Social Services and Youth.
In the long run, it means we'll keep shrinking. Young people leave, don't have families here, don't send their kids to school here, and that doesn't look very good for our region.
Especially in light of another sobering statistic, 100,000. That's the drop in the number of babies born in the region from 1995 to 2005 because the young women had gone. In Finsterwalde, Germany, I'm Kyle James for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, a small town in Vermont won its 15 minutes of fame today. Springfield beat out 13 other similarly named towns across the country to host the premiere of the Simpsons movie. The cartoon family, of course, lives in a cartoon Springfield. Producers held a contest to find a venue. 110,000 people cast ballots. They voted on videos the 14 cities submitted. So now the movie's going to premiere in Springfield, Vermont's 100-seat theater on July 21st. That's before it opens nationwide on the 27th. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 148 points, 1.1%. The NASDAQ fell 30 points, also 1.1%. The S&P 500 shimmied down 21 points. That is 1.4% there. Thanks to Miguel Macias and Renita Jablonski on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Wendy Sykes. Next time on this program, finding greener roads for daily drivers.
I don't use the freeways very much. You know, I'll never get on the 405. That's a kiss of death.
Boy, is it ever. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.